Hello.
And welcome to Lights Off on the Dark, the podcast where we explore the hows, whys, ifs, whats and whens of what it means to represent the Holocaust on stage. Sitting on my right in New York is co-host Alexandra Gellner, aka Alex.
I didn't realize I was on your right. Am I on the right monitor? And that was co-host Samantha Michka, aka Sam or Dr. Sam.
You can probably tell we're really excited because this week we have got our first ever guest on the podcast. Woohoo! So also in London, he's not in New York, which we're probably all very sad about, but he is also in London, director, teacher and writer, Stephen Unwin.
Now, before we bring in Stephen, it's time for the disclaimers.
So, disclaimer number one. Alex and I both work for outside organisations, but this podcast is entirely on us and we are not representing them. So if you don't like something you hear, it is all on us, and please don't blame Stephen either.
And disclaimer number two, the Holocaust is an incredibly dark subject, so because we work with it every day, Sam and I do use humor as a coping mechanism. We are not mocking the Holocaust. We are not mocking victims or survivors. We in no way intend to be disrespectful. We do use dark humor at times, so please bear this in mind while listening.
Mm-hmm. And the last one is less a disclaimer and more our rule of engagement. We want to hear from you. So if you have questions, a suggestion for an episode, a correction, please do reach out to us. And we'll give you the contact details at the end of the episode.
Now, this week, we are looking at the Nazi persecution of disabled people, known as Aktion T4, or Action T4. And the play we're looking at is All Our Children by Stephen Unwin. So we're so excited to have Stephen here to talk to us about it. Shall we bring him in, Sam?
Let's do it.
Hi, Stephen.
Hello.
How are you?
Hello. Fine. Very good. Very good.
Thanks so much for joining us. Listeners, you are hearing the voice of Stephen Unwin, playwright of All Our Children.
So this is where I do the incredibly awkward bit of summarizing someone's life and career to their face. Unless you want to do it for me, Stephen. I mean, you know all the best bits, so you can probably do it better than I can.
Well, there's not much to say. I've been working as a director, theatre director and opera director for a very long time, 40 years. And I've written lots of books and I've taught in all sorts of places. And a few years ago, I started to write plays, and in fact the one we're going to talk about is the first play I wrote, which I wrote in my high 50s, which is quite a late time in life to start writing plays. I am also a campaigner for the rights and dignities of people with learning disabilities. I have a son who has learning disabilities. So that's me. How's that? Is that enough?
Well, I guess this is where we test the accuracy of both Wikipedia and your website. It says that you read English at Cambridge, you directed so many student productions, including an award-winning production of Measure for Measure that was transferred to the Almeida in London, where you were awarded an Arts Council trainee director's bursary. Is that right?
That was when I was a kid.
Skipping ahead, founded the English Touring Theatre in 93. In 2008, you opened the Rose Theatre in Kingston. You've directed a large number of leading actors and actresses at all stages of their careers. You've taught workshops at organisations, including the National Theatre, the RSC, the Royal Court, the Actors' Centre, the Actors' Guild, the British Youth Opera, the University of California, Davis, Suburban College.
He's just like wriggling in his seat, Sam.
This is why it gets so awkward.
Stop.
But I wanted to also circle back to what you were saying about your writing, because also your most recent play was Laughing Boy.
Yeah.
And tells the story of Connor Sparrowhawk, who, you know, suffered appalling neglect and indifference at a unit in, I think it, he drowned in a bath behind a locked door in the middle of an epileptic seizure. And you wrote that play based on Justice for Laughing Boy, which was written by Connor's mum, Sarah.
Yeah.
So, again, like what you were saying, coming back to, you know, yes, being a campaigner for people with learning disabilities and sort of disabilities as a wider,
yeah,
wider area.
So, yeah, the learning disability thing has sort of emerged more recently.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least thinking that I could write about it and I should write about it. And I write a lot of journalism about it as well, which, of course, does inform all our children. It's become very important to me. And when I was talking about Laughing Boy, I said somewhere that it's sort of like the sequel of All Our Children. It's...
Hmm.
Completely different formally and in all sorts of ways, but it is sort of, yeah, it sort of is the sequel. It's that sense that the Nazi time may be behind us, but there are still, and perhaps will get worse, appalling
mm-hmm.
injustices and bad experiences
mm-hmm.
faced by particularly people with learning disabilities, I think, or with intellectual differences. That is a passion of mine, yeah. And I think one of the things that I care about and I slightly do is I sort of want to champion both the rights and dignities of people who haven't read so many books and been to such good universities and everything.
Mm.
I kind of do that a bit deliberately, I think, as a kind of, yeah, I think that learning disabilities is a kind of forgotten disability, and it's something that intellectuals, liberal progressive intellectuals, tend to find particularly difficult because they think it's at the opposite end of everything that they care about. And when we talk about eugenics, and of course this play is about eugenics, eugenics, we should remember, was supported by British and American so-called progressives in the 20s and 30s. Appallingly, I mean, dreadfully, and the kinds of stuff that happened was, I mean, Britain only avoided compulsory sterilization by the narrowest of And America sterilized people with just slight intellectual differences. In some states, my memory for numbers isn't good, but something like the last people were sterilized were in the 90s. So,
oh my God.
So there's a funny thing about All Our Children is that although it is about the Nazi period, its resonances and relevances do continue. Which I think is something that people, when they came to see it, found themselves quite struck by, that some of the arguments, some of the questions were still, shall we say, pertinent.
Before we talk in more depth about All Our Children, for those who don't know about Action T4, who know very little, how would you describe it?
Well, Action T4 was a specialist program of persecution and murder of a range of people, some of whom had intellectual disabilities, some of whom had physical disabilities, some of whom had psychiatric issues. These were Germans. I mean, this was in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, in some of the occupied territories as well. But they did, but thousands and thousands, I mean, as many as 300,000 people were murdered under this category. T4, it was called T4 because the headquarters of the program was at Tiergartenstrasse 4 in Berlin, which ironically was a confiscated a villa which had been owned by Berlin Jews, and of course it was confiscated and it was turned into the headquarters of this program. And what it put into practice is an argument that had been really first mooted after the First World War in Germany. A doctor and a lawyer called Binding and Hosch, I can't remember their first names right now, but anyway, Binding and Hosch wrote in 1920 a pamphlet called something like Allowing for the Termination of Lives Unworthy of Life. Lebensunwürdiges Leben. Lives unworthy of life, or it could be translated in a more modern way as people living lives not worth living, which is a phrase that you still hear. Mm. Anyway, so this was a kind of a theoretical thing coming out after the First World War, which the Nazis got fascinated by. And then when Hitler came to power in 1933, they put into practice compulsory sterilization. Large numbers of people. Some of the sterilization was done, some of it was with consent, some of it was forced. Anyway, that was between 33 and 39. And then with the outbreak of war, Hitler passed on the 1st of September 1939, Hitler wrote the special order or whatever it said, which is that such people should be put to death. But, you know, with two doctors had to sign off on it and had to be, you know, it was all dressed up in this pretense of, you know, that these were mercy killings, this was euthanasia. And anyway, this is what families wanted, and it was relieving the burden on families. And then this utterly poisonous argument, which you still see bubbles around, which is these people were so expensive to keep alive or to look after, that this was money that could be spent, on the poor, on, you know, motorways, on railways, on healthcare system, you know, and so on. So the arguments were made, and these were public, and they had quite a lot of popular support. The arguments were made that this was mercy killings, and that this was for the good of the general good. And what was called Action T4 went from 39 to sometime in 41, which is something that this play looks at. Mm. But the official program of T4, and the way that T4 worked is that there were these six killing centers across Germany, and people were taken from psychiatric hospitals or whatever the setting was, and put on these buses and taken to these places when they were gassed. And families were told that their loved one had died, usually told them their loved one had died of natural causes, all the usual stuff. Anyway, so T4, the formal T4 program finished in 41, but the murders of disabled people kept going through, obviously some of it in the concentration camps, but then some of it in psychiatric clinics where, you know, the SS would just go in and murder everybody in their beds and so on. And what I think about it is that is that it is one of the great forgotten crimes of the Nazi period, and it has been overlooked. And there is a strange irony, is that after the war, some of the people who were involved, some of the perpetrators, then went to the concentration camp, the extermination camps, and worked in those, in Treblinka and so on. Because what you've got to see is that Action Team 4 finishes in 41, and Axion Reinhardt, which was the real ramping up of all that stuff, happened, really started, got going in 41, and with the invasion of the Soviet Union. So quite a lot of the people, I think something like 700 people who were involved in doing T4 then went. And of course they were skilled in the technology of murder, of gassing and all the appalling things that they did. And also trickery. So they knew how to do it, and that's their skills were required. But what is striking is that after the war, the people who were involved simply in T4, in doing T4, were very, very lightly punished. I think six or maybe seven of them were hung. But many of them, and many of the doctors, were not just let off and not prosecuted, but they then had quite big careers in Germany and Austria after the war. And I think one of the things that's telling about this is that to a large extent, well, to what extent is a question, but to an extent, T4 had really just been the logical conclusion of what had been spoken about and in some cases practiced in Britain and America, particularly Britain and America, actually. France and Spain and Italy and so on, there was some eugenic practice, but not on that scale. So in a funny kind of way, the victorious powers didn't really regard this as, you know, as a war crime or as a crime. They didn't regard it in the same way as they regarded the murder of the Jews, and all the other terrible things. And so the punishments were very, very, very light, very what's the word I'm looking for? So that's the kind of that's the context of that's the historical context of the play. And one of the things that was striking doing it is how many people said, I didn't know anything about this program.
Oh.
You know, and people who were very knowledgeable about, well, not very, but pretty knowledgeable about the Holocaust. We then did, I directed the play in London. It was then staged in New York, not by me, but again, so many people had no idea about it. The final numbers of disabled people who were murdered it's very, very, there's endless debate. But I mean, some people say it's as many as a million. Other people say it was 250,000. And of course, they were disabled people who went to the camps and were murdered there. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's not a single crime. It's sort of complicated. I think it's probably worth recognizing that it. I mean, the definition of the Holocaust is complicated, and friends always say, no, you have to understand the Holocaust with the murder of the Jewish people. But I think there's another way of looking at it, saying this is part of the Holocaust, this is part of the murder of people who are regarded in some sense as inferior.
Exactly, yeah. Well, with all of that in mind, can you give us, I can give you more time if needed, but can you give us a 60-second synopsis? All our children.
There's an imaginary pediatric hospital in the middle of pediatric center in the middle of nowhere in Germany, run by a doctor called Dr. Victor France, and the play is sort of a work play because you see him, and you see the young, there's a young Nazi who's come to stiffen the program. There's a maid and so on. And this is a center for children, and the children are being taken from there and sent off to be murdered. There is, in Act Two, there is a visit from a real life character called Bishop von Galen, who was an interesting man. He was a, I've exceeded my 60 seconds, but let me do it. a conservative bishop, very conservative bishop of Munster, who in the beginning, when the Nazis came to power, he sort of went, oh, well, this is good. This is, you know, reaction against, you know, all that horrible Weimar Republic where, you know, which tolerated homosexuals and, you know, and women had work, had jobs and everything. That was all awful. But, and this is quite, in a way, the point, is that what he did, however, do, heroically and amazingly, is he delivered these three famous sermons against mm-hmm. disabled children. And as a result of that, Hitler stopped the formal T4 program. So in a way, it's one of the most remarkable acts of defiance of the Nazis. Now, as I said, they then murdered millions of other, hundreds of thousands of others in different ways. But the sermons were, the RAF got hold of them and they you know, scattered them. And they dropped the sermons on. And I think what Hitler felt is that he couldn't really face down the Catholics as well. So von Galen had a Catholic. So there's that. And then what is also running is the visit of a woman who's got a son there, who comes bearing cake and biscuits to thank them for looking after his son, her son so well. And she's a working class woman who works in an arms factory. That's in Act One. She arrives to thank them, wants to give her son a hug, but is told, no, we can't do this anymore. You know, it's all different now. But she then goes home. She finds a letter, and the letter says that your son died a week ago. So she then goes back and confronts the doctor who runs the clinic and says, you're a liar. My son is dead. And then senses what has really happened. This is kind of an important part of the play, is you don't at any point see any disabled kids. And it's quite complicated why I didn't do that, but you don't see them. But they are the only heroes of the play. They're the heart of it. You don't see them. And then I should say that Martha, who is the maid, is a sort of conservative German woman, good Catholic countryside. She's got three kids, none of whom are disabled, but she's worried about them. And through complicated things, she's right at the end, she senses that there's something horrible happening here. And she has a sort of realization that her non-disabled children are no different from the disabled children. So the play is called All Our Children, and it is, the title works on two levels. Well, it's a rephrasing of the biblical thing, you know, all God's children. It's also a political thing, which is people with profound disabilities are a shared responsibility. They are our children. So it kind of works on two ways. Anyway, Martha at the end senses something, and you see in Victor, who's the lead, that he's doing that thing that lots of us do, which is doing something he knows is wrong, but doing it. So it's that, those kinds of complicated areas. Anyway, so it's basically for It's a little chamber play for five characters.
And who would you say the target audience are? Is it for everybody, or did you have a particular demographic in mind when you were writing it? Or
no, because you don't really work like that. I mean, I knew that it. I wanted to write a chamber play. I mean, you know, I've read lots of Ibsen and staged Ibsen. It's a bit Ibsenite in some way. and you know, we did it in a tiny theatre. I mean, I think it should be done in a bigger theatre. It's, I mean, this kind of material, you know, unless you have some big star, is very difficult to sell, because it's like, what, date night, play about murdering disabled kids. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's like with respect your podcast, you know, it's like, we really want to go and see a play about the Holocaust? Do we really want to go and see a play about murdering disabled children? I mean, it did well, but I'm trying to get it on again, but it would need to have somebody very famous in it to make it, you know, make it. It's what it isn't, though, is like, it's full of, I mean, I hope it's full of human life. It's everyday life. I mean, in a way, it's everyday life in this clinic. And when it worked, people sort of would say, but this is just like my job, or this is, I recognize this. And you go, well, good, because this isn't that far away. The play has, for me personally, comes from three places. So my mum, who is amazingly still alive, was born Jewish in Hamburg in 1933.
Oh, wow.
She was, you know, she was destined is the wrong word, but things have been different. You know, she would have ended up murdered in Auschwitz, aged 9 or something. For that, they came to England in 1936. And as I say, she sat in Wandsworth drinking whiskey. You know, she's fine. but somewhere, although she never talks about it and it's not really part of who she is, but somewhere that trauma I've inherited, and I've read too much about the Holocaust, and, you know, I know too much about it. So there's that. Then there's the strange thing is that I was educated in, so Bishop von Garland is this aristocratic Catholic. I was educated in, I was brought up as a Catholic, although I'm now entirely lapsed, but in kind of intellectual Catholic stuff, which does exist in Britain still, sort of. And then I suppose the most important thing is then being the dad of a disabled kid to whom the play is dedicated. So it sort of worked, for me, it's three different things all kind of in some sort of, you know, Gemischte Salat.
All ties together.
Yeah, it all fits together. But, yeah, anyway, so the play is, I think, is full of empathy and horror, but you don't see anything horrible. You don't see any, you know, it's all in this office. It's all, and it's, I was quite struck by Miller's Broken Glass. I remember seeing that and thinking that was rather good. And just how you can't stare at this stuff is too much. You can't go into the gas chamber. You've got to approach it obliquely. So the published version, and I could never work out how to put this in the play, but the published version, I quote this incredible poem by Les Murray. Do you know it?
It's Dog Fox Field, isn't it?
Yeah. Can I read it?
Of course, please do.
I don't know if I'll get through it, but I'm going to read it. So this is a poem by the Australian poet Les Murray. And it says, "The test for feeble-mindedness," this is obviously from the Nazis, "the test was feeble-mindedness was they had to make up a sentence using the word dog, fox, and field. So that's just a little thing in italics at the top. And here's the poem. These were no leaders, but they were first into the dark on Dog Fox Field. Anna, who rocked her head, and Paul, who grew big and yet giggled small. Irma, who looked Chinese, and Hans, who knew his world as a fox knows a field. Hunted with needles, exposed, unfed, this time in their thousands they bore sad cuts, having gazed and shuffled and failed to feel the lure of prey and hound. They then had to thump and cry in the vans that ran while stopped in Dog Fox Field. Our sentries, whose holocaust does not end, they show us when we cross into Dog Fox Field. It's just, it's an unbelievable masterpiece, I think. So, I mean, that was an inspiration for me, that poem, and that sense of, you know. And my Joey, who's 27 and has no speech, he wouldn't have passed that test. Yeah, and just knowing that is quite sobering. And of course they would have got him twice because he's got a Jewish grandmother as well.
Oh, bless. I mean, we're going to talk in a minute about the when the play premiered in 2017 and then the New York production. But before we come to that, what was the trigger point for you to write the play? What was the moment where you went, okay, I have to write this?
Well, it was strange. I think I was reading Richard Evans, The Third Reich in Power. I think I was reading that trilogy of books, and I got in the third one. And suddenly he mentioned von Galen, who I'd never heard of. And I just went, and I remember reading a paragraph, and went, oh my God, know about this. And then that just set me off. I remember it's a funny story. My partner Ginny and our daughter B, for some reason they were away that weekend, I can't remember why, and I just sat down and I wrote the first draft in a day. I mean, it then took on a lot of, or maybe 2 days. Anyway, so I remember Ginny coming back on Sunday and saying, have you had a nice weekend? And I said, oh, I've got a terrible confession to make. I could see her sort of eyes narrowing and saying, you've got a terrible confession to make. What do you call this confession of yours? I said, I've written a play about the murder of disabled children. This is too disgusting. How can I have done it? You know, and it's funny, that feeling that it's too disgusting, it's too dreadful, is I still carry with me about this play. And yet, I think it's really important. It really, really matters. But So I wrote a first draft, which was had problems, actually, I think. And I worked on it. And then we did two or three play readings. Maybe it was only two. Or was it three? I can't remember. Sort of, you know, a year apart. And then I managed to get somebody wanted to produce it. We did it at Jermyn Street. But, you know, it got these fantastic reviews and much admired, and I got an endless kind of, oh my God, it's the most important thing I've ever seen. But it, you know, even that tiny theatre, it didn't sell out. So
really?
No, I think there is, you know, one's got to remember how daunting. I mean, appropriately daunting this stuff is. You know, this is... it's not date night material, really, is it? I mean, I was intrigued by how to make Victor, as who's the doctor, how to make him as human and normal and ordinary as possible, and not have some, you know, evil doctor. But then also how to make von Galen as kind of, in some ways, unappealing as possible, as sort of, oh God, you're just, you know, you are so, you're such a reactionary. not somebody who you want to have a coffee with, but peculiarly, I mean, this is what I think about history a lot, you know, but peculiarly at that moment did the right thing. I mean, you know, it's a bit like Churchill, who was an absolute monster in so many ways, but he was probably the right person at that moment, you know. So I think it's written with, well, it tries to be written with kind of three-dimensional empathy and humanity. But I don't have the kids, and I don't bring the kids on, and there are kind of various reasons for that. Firstly, I didn't want to make it, you know, sort of unwatchably horrifying, which is maybe me ducking, but I think it's also true. But then, you know, if you have the sort of people being murdered, where, you know, people with really profound cerebral palsy, or people in wheelchairs who, you know, I've seen these kids, you know, who've got real troubles. Or, you know, or somebody like my Joey, who has no speech. And so what are you going to do? You're going to have with Joey, say somebody, I mean, Frau Papp's son is really based on Joey. What are you going to do? You can't have Joey coming on stage, because he wouldn't, just would giggle, or he'd walk the other direction, or he'd look at the audience. You know, he's can't act. And if you don't have Joey doing it, then what do? You have an actor coming on, pretending to have no speech, or to be in a wheelchair with profound cerebral palsy. You know, and you can't just do that thing about, which the theatre always does about disability now, and say, oh, well, disability, that means somebody's a little bit autistic, or, you know, or somebody who's got a slightly withered hand, you know, represents all disability. Well, doesn't really. It's not really truthful, that. So it just struck me as kind of, to have done it would have raised more problems than it solved. And also, well, there was a really important moment quite early on in the play when Victor and Eric are going through the who's going to be transported that week. And it takes a bit of time. In the script, it feels quite short, but actually in the theatre, it takes a long time because there's a bureaucracy, and then he goes, yep, tick, two ticks. Yep, two ticks, each with a different person. And there are 32 to go through. And then he stops with a couple of them and said, no, not him, not her. So it was, that's the moment when the audience, and you could feel it in the theatre, goes, oh my God, we're actually talking about 32 individuals.
Mm.
Which is what I think that poem does, you know, Hans and Irma, and you actually think that these are individuals. But that struck me as a much better way of recognising the individuality of the victim, rather than sort of bad theatre bringing somebody on.
And going back to a bit to what you were saying about them going through the list, one of the things that I noticed when I was, because I saw the German Street production in 2017, and actually saw it, I think it was on the 3rd of June 2017, which was the night of the Westminster Bridge attacks, the London Bridge attacks as well. But one of the things that got me was, yeah, in that moment, because, you know, it is, for want of a better way of putting it, it's drawn out, because, you know, they do take the time to go through it. One of the things I really liked in rereading the play was the emphasis in the stage directions. It takes a long time because these are real people.
Yeah, I say
and just, you know, the fact that it's said twice, like, don't just go through like this is a phone directory and you're ticking off the numbers. These are real people. Give them that time to sit and consider and think about it.
I noticed that.
Eric smiles. Victor glances down the list. He checks each case study and says yes as he marks them individually with two red ticks. This mustn't be hurried. There should be 32 sheets, and each is a real person. After each one, Eric adds it to his pile. And it does. They get 29, I think. That's what I wanted to do, because you see, because what the crime is dehumanizing.
Mm.
What you've got to do is rehumanize. And that's the same with Laughing Boys. How do you rehumanize people who have been in different ways dehumanized? That's what I'm trying to do. One or two people said, you'd written a play about disability, you haven't got any disabled people. And I understand the criticism, but I also think perhaps as a very, very, as a horribly experienced theatre person, I also knew what would work and what wouldn't work, what just couldn't work. And I think that's, and then also somebody who was on the inside of, profound disability through my lad.
I sadly missed it when it was in New York in 2019. How was it received there versus its reception in London?
It was received very well. There were things in the New York production I didn't direct it, which was fine. I'd probably write something else like that. Frau Pabst was fantastic in New York. There were things there which weren't quite right, in my opinion. But it was very good to see it again. And it went well. A ringing review in the New York Times, so that was good. Mm. And as I said, I'm just working, finalising the screenplay, which is very different in lots of ways, and that's interesting. I'm very proud of it. And I want to do maybe somebody else direct a big British production, but it needs a stonking great big star in it to get it off the ground at the moment. I think people were quite struck by how, well, entertaining is the wrong word, but how,
engaging.
It's incredibly engaging. I was going to say, and you said it earlier, I think what really drew me to it is just, it's such a slice of life.
Yeah.
Play.
Yeah. That's what I keep saying, by the way, with the film people, is I said, this is a work play, that's the tradition of the work play. Well, there's the bit early where, Victor is talking to Martha, how are the kids? You think of all of those, films, I mean, it's deeply sexist, of course, but, the guy running the company with his secretary, did you have a nice weekend, love? How did the barbecue go? And how are the children? And how's, how's your little one? You were worried about her last week. It's kind of water cooler stuff,
Yeah, sorry, go on.
I know, I really wanted to catch that. And so the interesting thing in actually the experience of play, if you came to it without knowing, you wouldn't know what's going on until that moment that we described. You wouldn't really know what's going on. And that's important for me because it's not, the horror of jack-booted Nazis stomping around. Simon Higlett, who designed it, I remember he came to me with two totally different, he said, as I understand it, there are two different ways forward. One of which is we do a naturalistic office with, bookcases and panel wood and everything. Or the other is we do a white cube with meat hooks hanging from the ceiling.
Oh God.
And I went, no, it's got to be the naturalistic one with a fire, and it's quite cozy, and and carpet on the floor, a bit of carpet, and nice coffee, and that's what it's got to be. So that when they talk about that actually the kids, the wards, the heating's been turned off and it's freezing cold and they are starving. And it was just unspeakable, the kind of You know, there's death by neglect as much as anything else. And so it was really important to have that, you know, and that he's sitting there smoking cigarettes all the time and drinking, slightly, you know, to numb the pain of what is he doing. It was important to me that, you know, Victor, who's meant to be 50, you know, was a committed paediatrician. And I've met through Joey a lot of paediatricians in my life. You know, he's an absolutely committed paediatrician. And for a paediatrician to end up killing children, you know, or being responsible for killing children. And in the play, he doesn't do, you don't see him doing any doctoring until right at the end when he puts a bit of a disinfectant on Martha's cut eyebrow or whatever it is. And that's kind of really important that, you know, this is what those f***ers did. There are there are lots of formal and stylistic things in there and resonance. So it's set on the Feast of the Epiphany, which you will remember. Two things happens. Is one, you take the Christmas decorations down. And the other is that it's the visit of the wise men. So von Galen is the wise man, there's a brilliant play by Kleist called The Broken Jug, which has got an inspector comes to into a rural courthouse and sees the corruption. So there's a kind of there's a lot of German romantic drama in there. There's a lot of biblical, loads and loads of biblical references. Then there's Schubert, there's the Winterreise, which is the winter's journey, which is the music we use. And of course, von Galen has done a winter's journey to arrive through the snow at this place. And then that moment where it says fresh snow, new beginnings, it's a sense of, you know, the possibility of a new start. You know, so there's a lot of classical stuff in there, but then it's also two other big sources of my two favorite playwrights is Ibsen and Brecht. And there is the Ibsen thing, which is there's a secret, and you know, the play you discover the secret, really. It's sort of but then it's also Brecht, particularly in Elisabetta, who there's Brecht's short plays called Fear and Misery of the Third Reich, which is about how the Nazis corrupted institutions, corrupted professionals, whether it's journalists or law courts or medical professionals or the media. I mean, exactly what you see with Trump at the moment. And they corrupted it because in the notion of the German people's community, the Volksgemeinschaft. And those plays show that, but they show it in everyday life, not in Treblinka. They show it in everyday life. And that's really because there's a connection between that and Treblinka, if you see what I mean. So I wanted to show that everyday life, but then the Brecht thing is that the Elisabetta, who I always think comes from a kind of a German working class German communist background, you know, she goes, well, isn't this why we have to pay tax to look after kids like this, like my lad, you know, which of course is true, and she has a sense that this is a shared responsibility. Which of course in America they couldn't understand. That was the thing about the New York production, is they depoliticized it, but then Americans always do. Americans, Alexandra, you included, forgive me, I don't mean it like that, but it's the
no, I mean, I'm sorry, I'm embarrassed on
behalf of no I shouldn't have said it like that, I'm sorry, forgive
no
me.
Please do, because I mean I was curious to see, like, okay, how exactly was this handled, because yeah, I mean, any time I go to the theater, I'm like, yeah, we could probably afford to be a little bit more daring. And I think we're getting closer to that. I think after, especially if I may say, after, you know, after now that we've seen, you know, Zone of Interest, and there was a recent production of Our Class, I think we're moving closer to just getting a little bit more comfortable with being uncomfortable, of just like the mundanity of just, you know, how normal like these people were. So
it's not really about evil. It's not really about individual choice. It's about a society. So, you know, Victor knows that it's wrong, but he's still doing it. So is he a baddie or is he a goodie? Doesn't really work. Von Garland is a nightmare in so many ways, but he's also a champion. You know, it's like, and so that's why I said there are no heroes. The only heroes are these kids. You know, they're the only heroes of the piece. They're the people who I want the audience to really recognize their undeniable humanity, fundamental humanity. I mean, it's interesting, there's a tiny little thing about Jewishness in Von Garland, but there's hardly anything about it. And it's kind of important for me is to go, you know, of course I'm acutely aware of the enormity of the Jewish Holocaust. And as I say, my mum was destined for it. But there are other stories. There are other experiences, you know, by saying that one isn't, it's not kind of disrespecting it or undermining it. I mean, some people have said, you know, this is like, not the play, the time is a dress rehearsal for the Holocaust. In some ways, of course, the Holocaust was already going, but the enormity, the real enormity was from mid 41 onwards, 41, 42, 43. That was at 44. That was the real enormity. I mean, it was deeply unpleasant. I'm not pretending any other else. But anyway, some people do say it's a. So I wanted it to be a conversational piece with real people talking to each other, and to try to be as three dimensional and contradictory as possible. You know, so there's Martha. She says, Victor offers Martha the biscuits that Elisabetta had brought for her son, you know, and Martha gets the biscuits, and as she's getting the biscuits, she's saying how she tries to, you know, the important thing is to live a good life and to be moral, be a good Christian. And, you know, deliberately holding a packet of biscuits, which were destined for a lad who somehow regarded as inferior. And she thinks she's able to say, I live a good life. You know, and that's, you know, that's kind of those are the interesting contradictions, it seems to me.
I think as well, because when people sort of tend, when a lot of people, when they hear the word Holocaust, they tend to see things in absolutes, like the blacks and the whites, and well, Nazis bad, Jews good, this, you know, this whole kind of dichotomy. But then when you sort of, I feel like with all our children, what it does as well is it humanizes, and it shows that, and goes back to what you were saying, and something that I've always said is that, you know, the Nazis weren't all these jackbooted, marching, uniform wearing, Heil Hitlering group. It was the doctors, the lawyers, the teachers, the factory workers, it was everybody. And so that I think as well, and it also in a lot of ways reminded me of C.P. Taylor's Good, where, you know, you sort of have that doctor where the justifications that we make to ourselves as humans when we know we're doing something that we probably shouldn't. But then in that play, that shows the extent to which, you know, you kind of say, oh, but we're good people. Oh, but we're doing this for the right reasons. And then ultimately it ends up literally in participation in mass murder.
Did you visit any historical sites? Was that part of the process?
The honest truth is I probably didn't do quite enough, okay, because I discovered after I'd written it that actually the murder of the children mostly happened in within the hospitals, that the hospitals had these things called the special children's wards. Children on the whole, I mean, there were some, but on the whole, children weren't put on the painted out grey buses. And things like Eric coming to work there, and you know, there were things which I think are not, which a historian would not buy. Although I got a very nice email. There's a woman who's written a brilliant book about lives unworthy of life. And she just sent me an email just a couple of days ago saying she's reading it and how powerful it is. So it's not, I mean, I read most of Michael Burley's book on the subject.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked stuff up on, you know, I looked stuff up on the internet and in some history books about T4. But funnily enough, I learnt more about it writing my history of learning disabilities than I did in preparation for the play. So I think that a real historian of T4 would kind of go, yeah, it's not really right on some of it. But in a way, I don't really mind, because I think what I'm trying to do is explore responses, our own responses to disability, and particularly to profound disability, and to human value. And you know, I wondered, what I think is interesting is if it was just absolutely vile, savage murder, end of, there's not really much room for a drama. Whereas by having three-dimensional contradictory people in a working environment, it seems to me there's more spaces for an audience to come in. I mean, when I was first working, and I think in my first draft from that weekend when I was trying to get my act together about it, I think I suddenly realised there's no drama between a psychotic, cruel Nazi doctor, Mengele on the ramp kind of thing, or in the Auschwitz, to have a dialogue between him and a saintly Catholic bishop is, there's no drama. It's boring. It's just, you know, anyway, who are you trying to persuade? Because everybody, you know, any human being nowadays goes, well, you shouldn't, don't kill disabled children. We know that. But that's why I really went out of my way to discover how contradictory both figures could be. And so that the logic of T4, the logic of eugenics, which has a logic, it's just a dangerous logic. I wanted the logic of it to be enticing. I wanted people to go, oh yeah, all right, oh fine. So then as they're doing that, they're going, but where am I going if I say, oh fine? You know, I want an audience to think about a young person who is incontinent, who can't speak, whose mouth is dribbling all the time, who, you know, is in a wheelchair and can't, you know, it's very, very profoundly paralyzed and so on. I want an audience to think about that and go, how do I value that? What do I think about that if I was confronted with it? That's what I want the play to do. Where do I stand in this stuff? You know, because I've experienced a lot of that with my lad. You know, I've seen that close up, and that's, And I've also felt the frustrations of that, and the challenges of that, and the difficulty, and the campaigning to get support. And, you know, these things are real. Here's an interesting thing in the play, is in the first draft, Frau Pabst's son was called Joseph, and my son is called Joe. Joseph, which of course is German for Joe, for Joseph. And I think in writing that, what I did is I, if you like, put my fingers into the mains. I went, what does this actually feel like?
Hmm.
You imagine him in that. I then changed it because I thought that's too much. And I and then I called him Stefan, which is me. You know. And in fact, he's killed on my birthday.
My goodness. All right.
Well, it doesn't matter, you know, because you can put any date you like. Do you know what I mean? But then you go... Yeah. No, it's just like, get the electricity somewhere to fly, you know, feel it. Make sure you feel this shit. I mean, nobody else knows that.
Well, coming back, I mean, you've talked about the drafts and sort of the bits where you've gone, oh, you know, I've changed this. What made you choose to tell it from Victor's perspective rather than, say, like von Galen or Martha? Why Victor?
Because I wanted to... I suppose, partly, as somebody with some very limited social, political capital, and as a kind of, you know, a middle-aged bloke who's an atheist and sceptical and, you know, I kind of wanted to, in a way, I wanted to put myself or what I know, I wanted him to be a bit of me in the middle of it all. You know, when he admits to von Galen that he's got cancer, and von Galen says, I'll pray for you, and he says, yeah, I'm sure it'll help. It's kind of a dry wit, which I like, you know. So there's lots of things about, you know, and there's a self-destructiveness in Victor. I mean, I don't smoke cigarettes, but, you know, I've had moments of self-destructiveness. So there are a lot of things about him that I'm drawn to. And again, that's kind of daring yourself to be in there, daring yourself to be in that place. Whereas von Galen, although, as I say, I kind of weirdly, for complicated reasons, experienced that aversion of von Galen, that kind of intellectual aristocratic Catholic thing. That's not inside me, that's outside of me. There's an interesting thing, I think, which goes for a moral challenge, a challenge like with profound disabilities. What I found is that I thought you need an alliance of three kinds of experiences. You need the kind of intellectual leadership of von Galen, who has intellectual and political leadership. Okay, so he has a huge following of Catholics and he's articulate, you know, self-confident figure who could stand there and, you know, deliver and articulate it in theoretical terms as well as everything else. You then need the campaigner, the tiger mother, the I will do anything for my kid, which is Elisabetta. And I know some of them. I mean, I know Sarah Ryan very well, who was somewhere in the back of my mind with Elisabetta. Sarah Ryan, who's the mum in Laughing Boy. So you need the campaigning, lived experience fighter. But then in a way, the most important person you need is Martha, who is sort of the Trump voter, the Brexit voter, the sort of social conservative. And you need that person to recognise... need to make sure that they recognize, or you need them to go, but this is not taking us anywhere. The kind of ethno-nationalism of So that moment of her at the end, kind of recognizing the contradictions in her position, is in some ways the climax. Now, people find it difficult because, first of all, it's very emotional, very personal. And they go, but how can, you know, she's just this ghastly peasant woman, Catholic, voted for Hitler. You know, why should we give a shit? You know? But I kind of think that that's exactly the mistake, you know. So it seems to me for this to work, you need that. And then, of course, the other thing you need is you need doctors, atheistical doctors, being doing good doctoring, right?
Mm-hmm.
You could have the, you know, von Galen probably hardly ever met a disabled kid, you know. Or if he did, would just, you know, bless you, my child kind of stuff. So, you know, that's obviously the other person you need doctors, you need good professional atheists or at least, you know, professionals to do the job, which is once, if you don't have those, that it's an alliance of all those, not one. You can't have one of them by themselves. So, you know, the angry, the tiger mother doesn't win. The intellectual politician doesn't win by themselves, and nor does the peasant woman. You know, it's kind of reliance combination that makes it happen.
I mean, you create these you've brought these characters to life who are going through such, like, you know, immense internal conflict and tension. So I feel like I think that's really effective for audiences, because then they have to reckon with, you know, tension and conflict within themselves, which I think is why we are exploring all of these plays. It's, you know, it's asking us really challenging questions.
One of the challenges of the play is, one of the things that I've been wary of is it being taken as simply, you know, I'm saying that the answer to disabled children is the Catholic Church, which I'm really not. There are some details which I've woven in there, like Winkelheim, that clinic, I say, well, it was run by Catholics and then was taken over by the state because of what I call clerical improprieties, which was, you know, child abuse, you know, Catholic child abuse. There are deliberately stumbling blocks put in there to make you, and again, Alexandra, forgive me being like this, but that's one of my bigger worries about the play in America, is it getting kind of sort of simplified, turned into, you know, Catholics good, you know.
Right.
But it's...
We haven't succeeded with a total separation of church and state here.
Well, exactly. Exactly. Sorry, I mean, I'm...
Apologies, please.
I'm thinking of you guys on Monday with such sort of dread, but anyway.
I'm in a constant state of denial. Anyway.
Yeah, well... What else can I tell you?
I guess what would you say I guess three highlights, like if a teacher, because part of why we're doing this podcast is to, you know, help teachers and, you know, teaching the Holocaust, what are there highlights or, you know, excerpts for the play that you think would really be effective for students, I guess?
The play is sort of built out of a series of interactions between people, and literally interactions, exchange of gifts, exchange of stuff, you know. And in each one of those interactions, you can sort of see a template for how attitudes towards disabled people can be understood or misunderstood, or, you know, particularly profound. You know, the problem with the disability argument is that it's so easily, because the most vocal disability champions are so often the people who are not very disabled. there's this kind of whole danger of forgetting this thing, you know, which is profound and real and, you know, deep. So that I think that this is all the time is going around that subject of people who've got profound cognitive impairments, you know, where do they fit into our world? So I think the play is a sort of like a kaleidoscope, which looks at that stuff through a series of interactions every step of the way. And in fact, there was some talk at one point, but never came to anything, about the NHS using scenes from it to do training. I was prepared to, you know, find little excerpts and turn them into little training programs. But anyway, it didn't seem to come to anything. Although I wish it had. So I think it is. I think it could be quite useful in those terms. As a little pedagogic instrument, pedagogic machine. I think the question we talked, the second point is the question we talked about earlier, which is how do you write in naturalistic terms and in naturalistic sequences the enormity of the Holocaust? How do you begin to do it? Have either of you seen Vida's film about Janusz Korczak? Have you seen that? Do you know who I mean by Korczak?
Yes. Yeah, no, I haven't seen the film. Know who Korczak is.
Oh, look it up, Sam. It's incredible. I mean, it's an old film now. It's absolutely incredible. Anyway, so Korczak was an orphanage director and a pediatrician, had worked in Poland before the occupation, and it wasn't Jewish. But then, with the setup of the Warsaw Ghetto, ran an orphanage in the Warsaw Ghetto, and when the ghetto was being cleared, he went with his kids to Treblinka. He refused to leave his kids. And because he wasn't Jewish, he would have walked away and he would have had, you know, how do you write a play which is just in that orphanage? And what he was brilliant at is making it as ordinary as possible. You know, just everything was about maintaining, you know, good standards. And, you know, he ran a school there and everything. Trying to maintain humanity and normality surrounded by absolute poison. So what I'm trying to say is that for teachers and for drama students and for people who care about this stuff, where do you locate stories which somehow are real and tangible and you can find a way into from here? Because you can't go into the gas chamber, really. You can't quite dramatize the brutality because it's sort of impossible, I think. You know, and this is, of course, is what you know what they try to do in a Zone of Interest. So the play tries, you know, they tries to do that. And then I suppose the third point might be, which relates to that second one, is how do you create contradictory characters? And what is the value of contradiction? So Eric, you know, I was really determined that he should be, you know, the sexiest young man you could imagine. You know what I mean? And all the women who saw it would go, oh God, Eric, you know. And the gay men, you know, how did he do that? Well, he has a motorbike and he's handsome and he's cool and he's, you know, and then you understand how he gets off with Greta, with Martha's daughter. So, you know, I thought that was interesting. And then, of course, you then realize that what he's involved in is, you know, there are good children and there are bad children. There are wanted children and there are unwanted children. That kind of binary thing. So he wants, you know, good German, healthy, you know, all that crap about health. And that's what, you know, the strong young Eric, you know, that's his deal. And, you know, so what is the challenge about the fetishism of health, of strength through joy and all that stuff, you know? How do we alienate that in the British sense? How do we look at it afresh and go, where's that taking us?
Yeah, that's one of the things that really stood out to me. There's such a fixation on this idea of quote unquote normal.
Yeah. Well, and you've got to remember, you know, they had these Lebensborn camps where blonde, you know, Gretels would, you know, go off and have sex with, you know, 6'2" SS men in order to create perfect tall blonde blue-eyed children. And one of the things as I said earlier, one of the things I'm intrigued by is that, you know, the whole notion of inheritance is such crap. That's why I've stopped doing it now on social media because it's all so poisonous. But one of the things I've tried to say a lot or suggest a lot in the last 20 years or 15 years is I don't watch daytime TV. I care about Latin. I'm all this all this complete bullshit. I'm ludicrously over intellectual, and I have a kid who doesn't speak, and that is both things are entirely possible. You know, so one of the absurdities about the about immigration laws, you know, they go, right, we're going to let in the brightest and the best. And I always want to say, well, what happens if, you know, when I just left Cambridge, I probably would have been, you know, allowed into Australia or Trump's America, because you go, well, here's this clever young person who's, you know, is going to make it. And then, you know, then I become the dad of a profoundly disabled kid. And actually a few years ago, I had cancer. So you go, so human beings are more complicated. It's not simple, you know. That's the sort of thing I think the play, I hope, sort of unpacks how simplicity doesn't really work, because human life is complicated. Anyway, that was sort of a long-winded, burbly answer to your question.
Are there any other plays about T4, the wider persecution of disabled people by the Nazis, that you can recommend, and also any books or resources that you can recommend?
There is another play about T4, and I can't remember what it's called.
Is it The First to Go?
I don't know. I can't remember it, I'm afraid. So I'm of no use there. The resources on T4, Dagmar Herzog's new book called Lives Unworthy of Life is an absolute masterpiece, published by Princeton. It's a really, really good book. And then the sort of standard textbook is Michael Burley. That's a very, very good book by Michael Burley. I mean, I think T4 is, people are beginning to discover it. And there were British victims of T4. It's extraordinary.
Oh, wow.
People are beginning to learn about it, but it is striking how forgotten it is. One of the things I'm really struck by is how people who are, you know, yeah, complete progressive, you know, supposed progressives who, you know, who hate anti-Semitism, will then quite happily call people idiots and, you know, the terms of abuse which led to this, you know, catastrophe. So I think it's an uncomfortable subject, because it's for all the reasons we've been discussing, really. But that doesn't, you know, it's a knotty thing for modern progressives to get their head around, but they should, because it's important, you know.
Stephen, thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, thank you.
You're so welcome.
It was such a pleasure to speak with you. Yeah, Sam, do you want to take it away if we want to learn more about...
Yeah, so usual rules apply. All of the sources that we have talked about and also the recommendations that Stephen has given, we will put in the show notes for you. If you want to learn more about Stephen and his work or speak to him about All Our Children, I feel like I might be throwing you under the bus a bit, Stephen, and saying he'll be happy to talk about it. You can contact him at his website, which is stephenunwin.uk. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Oh, that was so special.
I feel
that was so nice.
I feel like I didn't know what to say half the time. I felt like I was just making these like noises, because you know when you just, you know, when you've seen somebody's work and you're like, you, yeah. Oh, it was, yeah. And having seen it and then actually being able to talk to him about it and kind of go, oh, and about why this? And also sort of hearing his perspective. Yeah. I'm still processing. Oh, Can you hear the wheels turning? I'm just like...
Mm. I was so jealous that you got to see it and that I missed it here in New York. Because I would have been really curious to see all the... just the choices that were made in the... New York production that he was talking about.
I thought it was really interesting what he was saying about the doing it in a bigger theatre, because where I saw it at the German Street Theatre, it's this tiny theatre, and it worked really, really well because you literally felt like you were in the doctor's study with him, which I know sounds a little bit twee. So I'd be interested to see how a bigger production would work out. And I'm also like really looking forward to seeing what happens with the screenplay.
Oh yeah, that's gonna be so cool. Yeah, I mean, I think I can't remember if I told you, but I was just every scene with the mother, Elisabetta, I was just sobbing.
Oh, bless you.
I mean, anytime I read a script, I just, you know, in that annoying actor fashion, just put myself in one of the roles. I'm like, okay, I would either be Martha or Elisabetta. So, but I felt most drawn to Elisabetta. And yeah, stay tuned for updates on the screenplay, I guess.
Oh yeah, I'm gonna keep bugging Stephen like from now to eternity, just being like, any updates, how about now? And now he's gonna be so sick of me, but
I know.
And it'll be good to see. I really hope that there's another production of it, and but it has got me thinking, who would be, in an ideal world, who would I cast as Dr. Victor Franz? And he said, you know, when Stephen said, you know, oh, big name, I've got thoughts, but I'm not a casting director, so
and you're not willing to go on the record on this podcast tell us your casting choices.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if it's a bit, because when we were talking with Stephen and I said about how some of the, there were points in All Our Children that reminded me of Good by C.P. Taylor. And I saw that however many years ago, recently, with David Tennant in the lead.
Right.
And the lead in that is very obviously a doctor. So I'm kind of thinking, you know, maybe David Tennant.
Okay.
I mean, I think he would be quite... I mean, if I could have my absolute dream, who I think would be perfect for it, I think actually Christoph Waltz would be amazing. Because he's just got that kind of craggy...
I was thinking the same thing, actually.
Just... You know, I mean, I know that he's played like the Nazi bad guy in, like, you know, Inglourious Basterds and things like that, but just that,
right? Yeah,
he's got the range, he's so good, and just that air of sympathy and the different facets that Victor has, you know, sort of when he's talking to Martha, when he's talking to von Galen, when he's talking to Schmidt, and just the different faces that he has to show. And I think Christoph Waltz would do that very, very well. So if you're listening, Mr. Waltz, please do reach out to Stephen and let him know that you'd be interested, because we think you'd be great.
Oh my God, I'm really obsessed with that casting.
So we'll have you as Elizabeth, Christoph Waltz.
I'm not enough of a name.
Franz. I mean, everyone's got to start somewhere, right?
Yeah, but man, this was, I thought this was a great play. This would be, I think, great in the classroom for, see, did we say the age group already?
We didn't talk about the age group, but I think, just the angle that I'm coming at it from is because there's some swearing in it, and also because of sort of the subject matter, and also how, like, the conversation between Von Galen and Victor, where it's kind of like you have these two intellectuals just sort of, it's not sort of real highfalutin, but it's, I would say,
it's up there.
So I would say, in terms of like age, I would say like 16, so in the UK, like year 11, sixth form, I would say.
I'd agree with that.
Because you wouldn't, I think 14-year-olds would probably enjoy the swearing. But I just think that the conversation between Victor and Von Galen.
Thank you so much for arranging this, Sam. That was a really great conversation.
You're so welcome.
Well, if you'd like to learn more about All Our Children and Stephen's work, we'll leave everything in the show notes. And how can they contact us, Sam?
So they can contact us by going to www.holocaustonstage.com, which is my website, and clicking on contact. And there is a contact form on there that you can fill out with your suggestions, with your questions, with your corrections. We're open to constructive feedback. And just hit send, and then that will come through to us. And we're looking forward to reading what everybody has to say.
I guess that's all from us. Thanks.
Yes. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next time.
See you next time. Bye. Thanks, everyone. Bye.